Save big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all-purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
Infinite complacency. People went to and fro the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
If you're on the hunt for another fantastic interview-based podcast to add into your rotation, look no further than Jim Harold's Campfire. Now, his format is just like mine. He talks to everyday people who have experienced extraordinary things, without dramatic sound effects added in. 'Cause these stories don't need it. He covers hauntings, UFOs, cryptids, and unclassifiable high strangeness. As you know, those are some of my favorites. And if that's not enough of a nudge, how about the fact that his shows have been downloaded over 60 million times, and that even just the campfire itself is in its 13th year? So do me a favor and follow Jim Harold's Campfire on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to Into the Fray.
I don't see myself as a prophet, but I'll take it as a compliment.
Dude, you are on the money today. Well, no, thank you so much for doing this.
No, absolutely. I've been a fan. I've listened to a few of your episodes on your podcast, and you know, whenever we followed each other on Instagram, it was like, you know what? I need to reach out. You know, there's only a select few of people that know this story of my encounter, and just being that you're open to it, I feel like I was willing to open up and just kind of tell you my experience as far as that goes.
Well, thank you for doing that. Well, yeah, Aaron, let's dive in then. So I know that you are in West Texas right now, and we are going to be talking about Bigfoot, and I'm assuming, but maybe I'm wrong, are we going to be talking about Bigfoot in Texas?
No, ma'am. So I'm working out here in the oil fields, and where my experience actually happened, I grew up in southern New Mexico. So that's where the area where I had my encounter actually happened. I grew up in a town called Alamogordo. It's around the White Sands National Monument. So where my encounter actually happened was on the Mescalero Apache Reservation, was actually where this all went down. And that kind of gives you a little bit of a where to know the area where I'm referring to, if that helps.
So that is interesting to me that it's on a reservation. As far as the subject of Bigfoot goes, when you talk to people on reservations, they're either, and no pun intended, they're either very reserved about it, or they can be open, depending on who is talking to them, right? So before we Correct. Get into your story, what was the general consensus on this reservation as far as Bigfoot goes? Was there already talk of sightings and things going down? Was it straight out, like people going, yeah, there's Bigfoot, you know, it happens, and some of us have actually seen it?
There was one particular story that I was told when I was younger, and it was from a couple of older gentlemen that had been up on this reservation basically they used to go up and they used to chase the wild horses. And that's kind of the work that they did. They would catch the wild horses, take them to the sales. Certain, you know, just older, these older guys that would talk about, you know, experiences that they had up there. And this particular story that I had heard was the one gentleman, he was riding down, he was horseback in one of the canyons that was on this reservation. And it was one of those, next thing you know, he hears a very, very loud splash. And he turns around and he looks as he's sitting horseback. And there's a decent sized boulder that is landed behind him. And he looks up and off the side of the hill, a second boulder basically comes flying off. And the way he described them was basically a man's shoulder width, a decent sized man's shoulder width. These are rocks that are being flung off the side of the hill. He leaned forward and kicked his horse in the stomach and started running. As fast as this horse could run, for the next, he said, probably, you know, it felt like eons, but for the next probably couple of minutes, these rocks were landing closely behind him and his horse as he was retreating out from this canyon on this reservation. He said, at this point, you're thinking about width of a man's shoulders. This is a boulder probably 3 to 4 feet wide, if not larger. And he said they're being hucked off the side of this hill like it was nothing. So he said something on the side of this hill did not want me in this canyon. So that's where it kind of leads into my story, is the fact that I was working for the USDA Forest Service. I was a range technician. I was working their summer program that they had. And I got a phone call from a cousin of mine. And he said, hey, my parents are at the casino, which is on Mescalero. And he said, they're going to be up there gambling, stuff like that. I know you're heading up back up to Redoso for the week to go work. Is there any way that you can pick me up at my buddy's house? Yeah, sure. No problem. I'm going to be heading up. And the actual turnoff of where this is at in southern New Mexico is a place called Nogal Canyon. You know, there had been a couple of friends of mine, a couple of cousins actually, that had been up in this area as well. And they had talked about, you know, they're out in the middle of the woods and it just, it goes suddenly quiet. You just, it's eerie. You know, you feel like something's watching you. And I didn't think anything of it. You know, it's just, I'm going to swing in, pick my cousin up, and, you know, we're going to head up to Redoso and have a good time. So head up there. And is it okay if I get into this now?
Oh yeah, go right ahead. Thank you.
I'm diving right into this.
It's perfect. You were, yeah.
Yes, you're good. So I leave my hometown of Alamogordo. I had stayed with my grandparents that weekend. I went ahead and had lunch and went to head up, and I left a little bit later in the afternoon. So by the time I was going to get up there, it was going to be a little bit closer to the evening. So turned off the highway, went down Nogal. We get up to a friend of ours' house, and I pick my cousin up, and we're sitting there talking and having a good time. And I start back down, and at this point, the sun is starting to drop a little bit lower. So it's kind of at that point where you don't have to turn them on, but your vehicle lights automatically kick on because it's just dark enough. So we start down into the canyon. There was a very low dip that you go into, and there was an apple orchard that was over off the side of the road. I start down into the canyon, and it's been 10 years going on now, and I won't lie, I still get choked up about this just because of what happened. But as I came down into the canyon, me and my cousin were talking, and I look over off the right side of the road, and I see like a brown mass color. And growing up in southern New Mexico, going into the mountains and stuff like that, you always hear people, you know, elk jumped out into my truck, they center punch a deer. And my first thought is, oh, okay, you know, there's some elk down here, I'm just going to slow down. As I let off the gas, and I slowly press my brake. And keep in mind, I drive a Nissan Titan, so I'm sitting up fairly high off of the ground. This figure takes a step out onto the highway. Now, I am on a two-lane road, and I can remember this just like it happened yesterday. It stepped out onto the two-lane road. As it took its second step, my headlights were shining, and my headlights hit probably about its waist. When it took, as it was taking the second step, it turned and it looked, and the reflection that happened that me and my cousin both saw was two red eyes that were probably, I want to say, 6 or 8 inches apart. It turned and they reflected from my headlights into the windshield of my truck. They were, and like I said, this figure easily, if I could have measured the shoulders were probably easily 6 feet wide, if not bigger. The second step, it hit, the head turned and looked away from my truck. It stepped off the road. It stepped over the 8-foot elk fence that was by the apple orchard that was right next to my truck in the bottom of this canyon. And this is where, at this point, your mind cannot grasp what's happening. You are trying to figure out what's going on. My cell phone was plugged into my truck so that we were going to listen to music. My cell phone was literally 6 inches from my hand. If you think that I could have grabbed my cell phone and taken a picture of it, anybody that I tell this story to, you were dead wrong. I was basically in that instance, I was frozen in time. And that's the best way that I can describe it. And where it gets weird, and you can comment on this if you want to, 12 hours away in northern Arizona, my parents had just moved to a town called Williams, Arizona. It was just outside of Flagstaff, up by the Grand Canyon. My mom got a feeling. It was just a gut wrenching in her stomach. She was like, I need to call Aaron. So she picked up her phone and she called. At this point, I'm doing probably about 85, if not 90 miles an hour out of, in my truck, trying to get out of this situation because I literally just don't know what happened. I had tears in my eyes. You know, you're trying to grasp what just happened. My cousin was screaming. It's in the moment. When she called, my phone started ringing and I had just got back onto the highway to head back to Ruidoso. I answered and all she could hear when she answered the phone was me crying and my cousin screaming. It was so big. It was so big. What was that? I mean, he was yelling at me in the middle of my truck. You know, it's your mind can't grasp what's going on. You're trying to process what has just happened. You feel the fear. This is where I think it's interesting. You know, you always hear of the motherly instincts and stuff like that that happen. The fact that my mom needed to call me when this situation was happening, that's just what makes this strange in this whole scenario. The fact is that when I answered the phone, she automatically knew that something was wrong. Honestly, if you were to talk to her, I think it was a good 5 minutes before I was able to calm myself down in order to tell her what happened. The thing is that this is where I love both my parents, because I will admit that my mom is a little more open. My dad's a little skeptical for things that happen, you know, whether it's Bigfoot, paranormal, stuff like that. He's gotten better through the years, but it was just kind of one of those. My mother was like, oh my gosh, this just happened. Okay, like, what do you need to do? So my dad got on the phone and he was able to calm me down. It's actually kind of funny because the first question that he asked, he said, Aaron, were you able to get a picture of it? And it's like, Dad, my cell phone was literally sitting on the middle console of my truck. And when you're in that moment and your mind is trying to process what happened, there was no grab my phone to take a picture. So we talked a little bit more. And keep in mind, I'm flying up the highway at this point. I'm probably doing 85, 90 in my truck, just not realizing how fast I was driving, just because you're trying to get out of that situation and you're trying to get away from what you just saw. My cousin is still, you know, basically bawling his eyes out. I'm slowly starting to process what had happened. That's where I was talking to my dad, and he said, when you get to Redoso, you need to go to the sheriff's department. Unfortunately, you know, this was summer of 2010. At that time, it was one of those, it's like, yeah, I'm not going to go tell the authorities. Like, what? They're going to laugh at my face. Like, are you kidding me? So finally swallowed my pride after I had, you know, my dad was able to calm me down and stuff like that. We actually drove up, got to Redoso, and I looked at my cousin. I'm like, dude, we got to go to the authorities. We need to let them know what's going on. And he's like, dude, this is all you. Like, he literally tears in his eyes in my truck, still trying to comprehend what was going on. We're both freaked out. So I walked into the sheriff's office in Redoso, New Mexico, and I said, I need to report a sighting. I said, me and my cousin just had an encounter. The lady that was there looks at me and she goes, oh, let me take you into the back room. So she proceeds to take us into the back part of the sheriff's department in Redoso, New Mexico. They have an entire evidence locker of all the encounters that have been happening between the last 10 and 15 years. They have video evidence of one of these creatures running in front of one of their sheriff's officers while he was driving down the highway at night. It caught it on the dash cam. They have casted footprints. They've got pictures of people's cabins up in this area, of handprint smudges coming down the windows. They officially logged this as the 12th and 13th sighting that had happened down in this canyon area of the Mescalero Apache Reservation. And it wasn't until after that had happened to us that we were able to actually talk to other people, older cousins, older family members, stuff like that, where they had had encounters and or had been in this same area and had things happen to them, but they weren't as open to talk about it. And I won't lie, but, you know, after it had happened, I'm sure if you were to talk to my mother about this, whenever she heard the phone conversation, when I'm crying and my cousin's screaming on the phone and they're trying to figure out what had just gone on, because it probably sounded like a murder had just happened. You know, you hit that point where it's like, okay, this just happened, but I'm a little more open to talking about it, because I was in the day and age where people will look at you straight in the face and say, oh, you're full of it. Like, you didn't have that encounter. You're just making it up. I went through basically the next, honestly, I would say 6 or 7 years of nightmares of that scenario happening, to where I'm waking up at 3-4 o'clock in the morning, you know, screaming my head off because I'm reliving it. You know, right now, this November, me and my girlfriend have been together for going on 4 years. When we first started dating, I basically had to have my mom tell her the story of my encounter, because I just, it's one of those, like, I could talk about it if someone was very receptive to it, but they could even tell that when I talked about it, I just getting shaky in the voice. I couldn't talk right. I was getting kind of closed off, reserved. So, you know, this is where I will say, I appreciate you reaching out to me and being able to tell you my story, because this is what went down. And the fact is that you're being able to listen to my experience and talk about it it's gotten easier. It's taken 10 years, but it's gotten much easier. So that's what I will say. So I do appreciate the time that you're taking today. That's for sure.
Well, I appreciate you being willing to share. I know it's not an easy thing. See, even 10 years later, it can get people. And I totally understand that. So, Aaron, I do have quite a lot of questions, if you're okay with that.
Yes, ma'am. Go for it.
So, and this is not me at all. The tone will not maybe say this, but I don't even want the question to say this at all. This is not me poking fun at you or going, why in the world would it be so traumatizing? That's not it at all. I'm simply asking, what about it do you think was so traumatizing for you and your cousin? The size, this eyes and the reflection, which I want to touch on a little bit more after you answer this, but what about it do you think was so traumatizing?
You know, in all honesty, when I think about it, the traumatizing part was that when I go back and I'm able to play this whole situation out in my head, see what had happened. This creature stepped across a two-lane highway in less than two steps. The first step, it hit the middle of the road. Adding to this, the head turn and look at the truck, the reflecting red eyes, because I had easily guessed this creature at a minimum of probably 8 feet tall, if not more. Like I said, I'm sitting in a Nissan Titan, and my headlights, they weren't on the brights, but I have a leveling kit on my truck. The headlights were at its waist. So it was just enough of the headlights that the eyes were able to catch when it turned and looked at us that you could see the reflective part. And that's where the fear sank in the most, because on top of the red eyes looking at us, you have easily a 5.5 to 6 foot shoulder broad. And the one thing that I do remember was that the hands swung down by its knees. So the arms and the shoulders between it was monstrous. It was huge. I mean, it was every bit as big as my truck if it was laying down sideways next to my truck. So the fact is that it was looking down towards us. Your mind cannot grasp the size of this creature on top of the easily 6 to 8 inches apart red eyes that are turning and looking at you. And then as it stepped off the road on the second step to walk over and just easily casually go over an 8 foot elk fence and walk out into an apple orchard, it was just one of those that, like I said, it just, you punch the gas on your truck and you're just trying to get out of that situation. So if I could pinpoint the fear part, it was the combination of the size of the creature, as well as when you look up, you just have two glowing red eyes looking at you. And the best way that I can describe the eyes was that when you're driving down a road and you have it's hard to describe, but basically the reflective road cones,
mm-hmm.
that are the red, or that's the best way that I could describe it. And easily as big around as a normal person's fist. So they were decent size and they were spaced quite a bit apart. It just, in front of this huge mass that you just see of just this brownish black figure that's stepping out in front of you. And, you know, it's kind of one of those, when you first see this unfolding, you know, I'm hitting the brakes thinking an elk's fixing to dart out in front of my truck. And next thing you know, this figure walks out and you're just like, whoa, holy crap. And that's where just the combination of the size of the creature and the red eyes, that's basically where the fear set in. That's the best way that I can describe it as far as that goes.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
No, that totally makes sense. I could see where you're kind of trying to process very quickly in milliseconds what's going on. You're going, oh my God, they're real. Oh my God, they're real. And now you're knocked down several pegs in you know, the scheme of things in life, right? As far as being alphas, right, and running the show when you're out there, it's not true.
Right, exactly. Well, and I'd never been closed off from, you know, believing in Bigfoot. I had watched several documentaries, and of course when I was younger, it's not as predominant as I am now. I mean, I totally watch Expedition Bigfoot, just anything that is Bigfoot pertained on Travel Channel, History Channel, your podcast. Like, I'm watching all this stuff now just because I had my encounter. Now I know they're real. I know that they're out there. So the more that these people are gathering evidence, I want to see it. And it's bad because on Sundays on Travel Channel, you know, they'll have specials about Bigfoot encounters and stuff like that. I have the TV on it all day, you know, so I wasn't closed off, but it was just kind of one of those, a good old country boy from Southern New Mexico, like, oh yeah, you know, whatever. And then you have this encounter that happens, and it opens your mind up, and it opens just your whole senses to this whole deal of, you know, there's something out there that I've seen that they are trying to collect evidence on. So I want to see what happens. So it just, you're very more in tune. You're very more open. And after this encounter, it's not so much Bigfoot anymore. Like, the aliens, UFOs, spaceships, stuff like that. You're more open to it because it really does, at your core, it changes you. You know, especially having an encounter. And I know a lot of people can't talk about what I've encountered because they haven't had that. So I know there's the skeptics out there. But at the same time, I can look at somebody in the face and say, this is what's happened to me. I know that they're out there. So I'm more open to, if you're going after it, I'm going to support you 100%. So that's kind of more so how it opened me up. And like I said, it was I want to say, honestly, for probably after the encounter for a good 6 years, it affected me mentally. And it was just one of those, like I said, you're waking up in the middle of the night because you're reliving this whole situation. You know, I talked to other people that have had a couple of encounters like I have, not as up close and not as personal, but they say the same thing. It changes you to the point where you're affected, and it takes you years to get over. And like I said, whenever I was able to reach out to you, like I said, this was back in 2010. I'm just now able to talk about it and talk about my experience, and my voice is still shaky, but I can talk about it to people who are open about it. Like I said, it's hard, but the fact is that I can talk to somebody about it who wants to ask questions, wants to find out more. That's where I'm more receptive to it. Like I said, I've had a lot of believers, but I've also had a lot of skeptics over the years. And unfortunately, you know, the skeptics get to see my bad side, because it takes a lot for me to well up and start crying talking about something whenever they tell me that it's not true. But when you get in a lady's face and you're screaming at her because she basically calls you a liar, it basically says a lot.
Yeah. And why would you want to put yourself through that unless it really happened?
Right. Exactly. Well, and that's kind of one of those, you know, when it first happened, I got a lot more, a lot of people were receptive about it because, like I said, I had older cousins that were reaching out and saying, hey, well, yeah, I understand what happened to you because this is what happened to me. And they're basically telling me about their encounters, and they're basically telling me, you know, I was in the same area and, you know, I'm out there deer hunting, and next thing you know, the entire forest goes quiet, and literally the only thing you can hear is your own heartbeat. And it's like, yeah, okay, so this is making a lot more sense as to, you know, I have these older guys that don't open up as much as I can open up, and they're telling me about their experiences within the same area of this reservation. Well, yeah, this is what happened to me. This is what happened to me. Did you feel this? Did you sense that? And it's like, wow. Okay. So I'm not crazy. Cause that's the first thing that goes through your mind when something like this happens. It's like, I'm nuts. I'm psycho. I'm crazy. Like I imagine that. And then once it sets in as far as reality goes, and then you have other people that are reaching out and saying, hey, no, this is what happened to me. This is what I saw. This is what I felt. It makes you feel better about the scenario because you're not more reserved about it, just because when you get into the older generation like that, they were a lot more reserved about having encounters and having experiences because that was the first thought. Oh, you're crazy. There's no way that happened to you. So, you know, it made me feel a little bit better that I was able to open up about it. But like I said, for the first probably 5-6 years after it happened, you know, I'd be telling the story to somebody, and you know, I'm sure you can hear it on your end as well, just shaky voice, you know, about blowing up with tears, because it's not something that's easily talked about, but it's an experience that I want to share just because if it reaches out to somebody else, if they had a similar experience, they can relate. And that's kind of where I'm at in my life right now.
So you worked for the Forest Service in the area at the time. Once this happened, did you open up to anybody at work? And then did they have any corroborating evidence or sightings?
You know, it was kind of one of those. After we left the sheriff's department, and we were the 12th and 13th, you know, being that they took my cousin's account, being that we were the 12th and 13th sighting, I won't lie, whenever I left the sheriff's department, I just kind of shut down. I did want to talk about it at work to other coworkers and stuff, but when it had just happened, you're very reserved. You're very quiet. I was still trying to process what was happening. My parents were still fired up about it, so it was kind of one of those, you know, my dad was calling me saying, hey, how are you doing? Have you talked to anybody about this? And it's like, no, I really don't feel comfortable. Even though I had coworkers that I was close with, you kind of shut down. And that's the best way that I could describe it. And more so, it was just because I didn't want my coworkers looking at me thinking, oh, this guy's nuts. Like, we need to get rid of him type deal.
Right.
You kind of just close up. At the time, I actually had another cousin that was the actual district ranger of the USDA Forest Service in Ruidoso. And I was actually able to kind of mention it to him. And he was like, wow, really? But it was kind of more, he was receptive to it, but he didn't really talk about it after that. So, you know, it just, like I said, I wanted to. But at the same time, between me and my cousin not wanting to talk about it just because that's what it had happened, and then my parents, you know, being in on this, as far as that goes, I had a few people reach out as far as other family members, because that's usually my parents or my dad was telling them about it. But as far as coworkers went, it was kind of one of those. I was more so scared for my own self of, oh, I can't really tell anybody this because they're going to think I'm crazy.
Yeah, that's understandable.
I was working, like I said, I was working up there for the summer because it was just part-time while I was going to college. So it's kind of one of those, it's like, you know, what happened happened. I'm not going to mention it to who I work with. And then whenever the summer's over and I go back to my hometown to continue my classes, I'll just kind of let this die off. So it, you know, I wanted to talk about it, but there was just only certain people that I could talk about it about, you know, and that was my first solid, probably 2-3 years about it. You know, it just, like I said, other people that I have talked to that have had encounters like that, it changes you because it takes several years in order for you to get over a traumatizing experience, because even if you're receptive and you're open, yeah, you know, it's real. And then you have something happen like that. It changes your whole perspective on life. So that's kind of where I was on that, just because I could talk about it if I wanted to, but it was only towards somebody who was receptive about it or had had a similar experience. So, like I said, as far as coworkers went, none of them actually know what had happened. And that's just the bad part is that when you have something like that happen, you end up shutting down. And I don't know if it's the best way to go about it, but that's just kind of that was kind of my experience as to what happened.
Now, how about the sheriff's office? You said that you and your cousin became the 12th and the 13th, you know? So they said that they had video evidence, including video evidence of one of these things stepping in front of a squad car, and it got captured on the dash cam, and then they mentioned pictures. Did they just tell you this? Did they show you any of these items that they were talking about?
They did show us foot casts. So they did have casts of tracks that have been recorded out through that area. A lot of footprints. They didn't actually show us the video evidence, but it was several months later. I believe I was watching it was one of the Bigfoot shows, and they had actually played the sheriff's officer that was driving at night and had caught it on his dash cam. And it's hard to see, but it's basically one of those, you can see a bipedal figure basically running across the highway. It's about 3 steps as the headlights come across, and you can see it from about the middle to waist down, and it's stepping over the guardrail that's actually over on the left side of the highway. They actually submitted that video to one of the Bigfoot research organizations, so they were actually able to play that on live television. But it was basically in their back room, and they had taken our statement. They, you know, asked us what happened and were able to document everything that had gone down. But it just, the way it was set up, they basically had just this back room that was behind the fence of all of their evidence that they had had over the years. And I can't say how many years, it was one of these. We just basically walked back and kind of saw everything as far as foot casts and everything had went. So they were, that's the one thing that I will say is that the sheriff's department was actually really receptive to when we showed up and gave our statement. You know, they weren't looking at us like we were crazy. They weren't shut down about it. They were like, oh yeah, okay. So this happened to you guys. And they took our statements. And then that's when they were able to show us, you know, the actual back room of their evidence that they had collected. So it kind of gave us a little bit of relief, but at the same time, you're still walking in there to a, you know, law enforcement department and thinking, oh God, they're going to throw us in the loony bin. That's exactly what I was thinking at first.
Well, it makes you wonder how many of these little back rooms with all of this amazing evidence there is across the country, right?
Right. Exactly. And that's where we both felt better whenever we saw they're kind of piling evidence. So it's like, okay, you know, if you do come to somebody now and say that you've had an encounter, they're not going to be shut down and think that you're crazy. They're actually going to be pretty open to it and say, yeah, well, this is all the evidence that we have. And it just, like I said, it was kind of more of a relief, but at the same time, for the next several nights, I was not able to sleep for anything.
Yeah, I mean, when you're going down the list of the headlights hitting the waist, the second you said that, I'm like, oh my God, that is a massive creature. Because you talk about being in a Nissan Titan and the hands down, you know, by the knees or below the knees, that is stunning. So was this thing standing when you first caught glimpse of this, you know, brown figure at the side? Was it crouched at all or was it already standing up?
The best way that I can describe it was that it's almost like it was behind the trees. So the only thing that I can figure was that when I first glanced over, I was probably catching the leg or the arm sticking out. It's hard to describe just because it was just this brown mass that was on the right side. And like I said, you know, the headlights are barely hitting it. So it's kind of one of those that's like, oh, it's probably an elk stander right there. You know, it's fixing the dart out in front of the truck. So I'm just going to stop. From that point, that's when it basically emerged. So if it is a, you know, if it's one of those scenarios where it was actually probably waiting for me to drive by, you know, it's probably like, oh, okay, I've seen one of these before. I'm just going to walk out behind it. Being that I stopped, it was probably like, oh, okay, well, I'm just going to do this anyway. But as far as that question goes, the best way that I can describe it was is that it was just a mass that was dead even with my truck. But the thing is that where I sat on the road and it dropped off, it was probably a good 2.5 to 3 foot drop. So I would venture to say the first part of it, as best as I can remember, it was probably the shoulder part or the arm that I first saw. So it was probably standing behind a tree waiting for me to go by. And this is just speculation from my standpoint. But the fact is that when it stepped up onto the road, and then it's kind of one of those, it's like your headlights are hitting this thing at its waist. It's like, holy crap, this is an actual huge creature. So that would be the best way that I can describe it, because it, like I said, it was a good, decent, like 2.5, 3 foot drop off of the main road that was right there. So the first mass that I saw, I would venture to say it was probably, like I said, the shoulder arm part that was sticking out from behind the tree.
And did it square off towards you guys at all with its chest?
It wasn't really a square off. It was just kind of one of more of those, like the best way I can say is that the first step, it was coming from the right side of my truck to the left side of my truck. The first step was with its left foot. So when it got completely in front of my truck and it turned and looked at us was when the right leg was coming for the second step. So that's when I was able to see how actual wide.
Okay.
This creature was, and right. You know, arms hanging down as far as that goes. So it didn't really square off. It was just more of the motion of it walking across the road, but it was like almost, oh, I'm glancing at this truck. And that's when it turned. And then that's when I remember seeing the red eyes. So it's almost like it was going to walk across the road anyway, but being that my truck was right there, it was just kind of taking a glance. But at the same time, when it took a glance, the left arm was back behind its rear, and then the right arm swung out. And that's when I noticed that the fingertips are basically down just below the knee. So like I said, just a massive creature. It didn't have to square off just because it was so massive whenever it walked in front of us.
Yeah, that's pretty sobering, huh? How about its gait? Was there anything funny about the two steps that it took?
Not really. It flowed very well. That's one thing that I will say. Being that this creature was as massive as it was, and I'm on a two-lane highway, like I said, essentially it was two steps. It was two steps across this highway. And it's not even really a highway. It was just a paved road. But it flowed very well. It was very... Even though I was scared in the moment of what was happening, it was very majestic. And that's the best way I can describe it, because it walked across this road in two steps and there wasn't, you know, a hesitation. There wasn't, it wasn't gimping. anything like that. It was just a very smooth walk across. And I was able to talk to some Native American tribal members later. And they were like, well, you were scared in that situation because you're trying to figure out what's going on. Did you feel threatened at all? And in all honesty, I didn't. I mean, my brain was trying to process what walked across in front of me and what looked at me, but I didn't feel like it was coming after me. And that's where they said that, you know, in Native American culture, that's where they'll say that these are actual peaceful creatures. And that's what made me feel a little bit better about it. Yeah, I was freaked out and I was scared because I had just had an encounter. But at the same time, it's just kind of one of those, you know, he was basically just walking across the road to get to the other side. And it was just kind of, it flowed very, very smoothly. And that was the thing was, is it just, this thing walked across a two-lane road in two steps and took a glance over and then just kind of casually walked off into the forest.
And when it reached the 8-foot-tall fence that you said it easily went over that, did it put a hand on the fence or did it just climb right over?
The left hand went on the top and it basically just, it almost like it stepped over it, like how you would step over a barbed wire fence.
Mm-hmm.
I would honestly say, and this is where I say that this creature was so massive, because when it walked over and it put its hand on the elk fence, which I know elk fences usually run between 6 and 8 feet. So I can't say how tall that this elk fence was for sure. But when this creature reached out, the elk fence was below its shoulders. So the shoulders and chest going into the head was over the top of this fence that surrounded this apple orchard. Like I said, it went over it with ease. And it's kind of one of those, I can't say if it just basically jumped over the fence or if it stepped over it, because at that point it was out of my headlights, but you're watching this creature basically just glide over this fence that keeps out creatures that can jump 8 to 10 feet. It just, in, like I said, probably 2 or 3 steps, it had completely just vanished into the forest.
Now, I don't know if you can answer this question, especially since you had the face in profile until it looked at you, and then you're just hit with these really amazing mm-hmm. and very wide set and traumatizing red eyes. But could you tell at all if it had the more gorilla type looking face or the more human type looking face?
The problem was, when I go back even to the encounter, and then when I've had, you know, the nightmares over the years, the only thing that your brain can focus on was the reflective red eyes. So the one thing that I can say is that being that the eyes were spaced apart about 6 inches, they were actually set back further into the skull. So there was some protrusion as far as the forehead and everything went. But as far as the face went, your mind, I couldn't see a face, because the only thing that you're focused on is the reflective red eyes.
Yeah, no problem.
So it's hard to say, but the thing I can say is that the red eyes were set further back. So there was, like I said, there was a very large forehead. You could see the space in between the eyes. But like I said, when the headlights hit the reflective red eyes, that's basically all your mind can focus on. You know, it's like I told my dad whenever he called me, I wish I could have grabbed my cell phone that was sitting right there on the middle console of my truck and take a picture. But you're frozen in time. That's the best way I can describe that. So that's the best description I can give you. Whenever it turned and looked at us, was that the eyes were set back in the skull a little more. So there was a very large forehead, but it just, the reflective eyes, it kept from being able to see any details in the face.
Now, once you guys got to where you were going, at what point, or did you even have to go back down that very same road to go back where you came from later on?
Being that it was off the highway, I did not return. It was kind of one of those that was off the main highway, probably about 15 minutes. I drove through that area every weekend because I would work up there for the weekend, then I would come home on the weekend. So I drove through there quite a bit. you start getting closer, and the hair on your neck stands up, your muscles tense up, you reach over and you're turning up the radio. You're trying to keep your mind off of it. And then when you see the turnoff, you know, you're kind of stomping the gas, trying to just get past it as far as that goes. I do know that there were several friends and family members that, like I said, had been in that area before and had had not so much a similar encounter, but, you know, I had a cousin of mine say that he was up there one day within the same specific area. And, you know, he's trying to scout and go deer hunting and elk hunting and everything like that. And he said, you know, it's in the evening, you're out in the woods and there's not even birds chirping. You know, he said it gets really, really, really quiet. You know, the hair stands up on the back of your neck. You feel like you're being watched. And he's just, you know, he said, you're in this situation. It's kind of one of those, you don't know what's happening. You don't know what's going on. So as far as returning to that area, I never did. And neither has my cousin. His buddy lives up there. We had talked to his buddy about it. And he was like, oh, yeah, you know, there's several older people that will say, yeah, you'll see stuff out here. You don't go out after dark or anything like that. And it's just kind of one of those. It's like, yeah, I just assume not return to the area. So I drove back through that area quite a bit, but I made sure it was not in the dark. I would usually get done on Fridays. I would venture to say probably 3-4 o'clock, because I had enough hours at that point where I could get off work early. I made sure I got off the mountain before dark set in. You know, it changes your perspective on things that can be in the woods in the dark. And it was like, you know, I'm prepared for it, but if I never saw a creature like that again, it would be too soon.
How far from the truck do you think this thing was?
Probably where I'm sitting on my couch to my TV. I would venture to say right around 6, maybe 7 feet from the front of my truck.
Oh, goodness gracious. Okay.
Yes.
Was
that's,
he?
And that's where the fear set in the most, was because it was so close to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one thing for the sheriff's department to say, yeah, it ran across in front of a squad car and we could see, you know, the legs with the headlights. No, this thing was not several feet in front of me. This thing was within arm's length of my truck when it walked out.
Yeah, I was going to say, with where the arms were hanging, it could damn near just reach out and touch the hood.
Easily. And if not, if it was going to be aggressive at all, it could have destroyed my truck. You know, but like I said, with sitting in a Nissan Titan and you're looking up at this creature where its eyes were at, like I said, minimum 9 feet tall, especially mm-hmm. because it was so close whenever it stepped out.
Yeah, Aaron, I think you're forgiven the nightmares. You know what I mean? I think if anybody could actually even attempt to put themselves in that situation, and you're out in the middle of nowhere to boot, yeah, I would say you're allowed to have nightmares about that.
Like I said, it was within the next 5, 6, even 7 years. And like I said, this November, me and my girlfriend will be together we're going on 4 years. I had to have my mom tell her the story, because I couldn't talk about it. You know, it's one of those, you're very reserved and who you talk to. And, you know, it's 10 years later and I'm able to come on your podcast and talk about this because I'm more comfortable. But those first few years, it was really rough, because it's one of those. It's like I'm scared to go to bed and I don't want to relive this situation. But at the same time, people who are receptive and say, oh, well, I've seen this, I've had this happen, blah, blah, blah. You try to talk about it to see if it'll at least give you some relief as far as that goes. You know, it's with how close this thing was, with how the detail that I was actually able to see and being able to talk about it. But at the same time, like I said, you know, my mom getting her motherly instinct of when this situation was going on, she got this gut-wrenching feeling that she needed to call me. And when she calls me, I'm bawling my eyes out and my cousin is screaming and she's trying to figure out what's going on, because she said, it sounded like we had just seen a murder. That's basically what it sounded like on the phone. So it's very interesting that side of this whole scenario that played out, you have that instinct of like, oh, I need to call my kid. Something's wrong. Because she was right. Something was wrong. Something had just happened that we weren't able to explain. So that's kind of one of those, you know, I'd come down, you know, fixing to go to work, and I'd kind of have, you know, bags under my eyes, and my mom would look at me and say, what's the matter? I woke up last night and had a nightmare. And she'd say, oh, I'm sorry. And she automatically knew what was keeping me up at night, or what was waking me up in the middle of the night. And I'm, you know, waking up screaming because the whole scenario is happening in my head again. So yeah, it was kind of one of those, the whole situation, the whole encounter, the whole side of her story, being able to tell this, it was all very, very mind opening as far as that goes.
And that likely probably doesn't have anything to do with the Bigfoot itself. More so it has to do with your connection with your mom. And correct me if I'm wrong, but this may have been the most scared that you'd ever been in your life. And she sensed that.
I would agree with you as far as that went, because I did not feel in danger, but like I said, you're trying to process what's going on in front of you, and you can't explain it. You can explain it later, but in that scenario, you can't explain what's happening. The thing is that you're taking this all in. Then I have my cousin in the passenger seat who's screaming and crying and yelling out curse words that I had never heard before. You know, just this whole scenario, it was just kind of one of those. I would agree with you wholeheartedly that she was like, okay, something's wrong, and I need to reach out. From the time that I answered my phone, when my mom started talking to me and then my dad got on the phone, this was probably a good 30, 35 minutes that they were talking to me. So, you know, being able to get me to calm down and talk about what had just happened. And of course, you know, that's my dad being who my dad is. Well, did you take a picture of it? No, Dad, I didn't take a picture of it. I couldn't.
No, well, that stuff doesn't cross your mind. And I hear that time and again, or somebody will make a comment, you know, under a post. It doesn't even have to be my post or my episode, but people are like, oh, you know, bull crap, that didn't happen. You didn't get a picture. Okay, bud, let's see you be actually in that situation and see if it even crosses your mind to grab your phone, to grab a camera, and actually document this life-altering experience. It probably is not going to happen. You will probably end up being this very same person who's getting reamed for not grabbing their camera.
Exactly. Yep. And it's just one of those, well, how come you couldn't snap a picture of it? And it's like, you know, I had just gotten a smartphone. I think I had upgraded to the brand new Droid X. And for me to pick up my phone, swipe it open, and hit the camera while this is happening in front of me, yeah, it never even crossed one of my hairs on my arm, because that's how close my phone was.
Now, Aaron, what about, because you talked about, obviously there's a certain area that seems to be more of a, I mean, for lack of a better term, a hot spot within the reservation. But you also talk about, and I'm assuming it's maybe a little bit bigger area or the exact same area where you have these cones of silence, we'll call them. Now, this is my ignorance as far as reservations go. Is there certain areas on the reservation where there is or is not hunting? So I guess where I'm getting at is, where these sightings in these areas of silence where the birds are really quiet is happening, is this a hunting area, a non-hunting area? Is the entire reservation up for game, pun intended?
Yes, ma'am. The entire reservation is open for hunting. Back in the earlier days, and I want to say probably the early to mid-90s, it was one of those, as long as you knew a tribal member that lived up there, you could actually go hunt on their property. No game tags or anything like that. I know stories of my dad talking about older friends of the family that lived up on the reservation because they actually were Apache, and they were actually able to go hunt deer and elk and everything like that. As far as the sounds of silence goes, these are coming from guys that had been hunting up there for years. I can't say it specifically in the same area where I had my encounter, But I can honestly say that most of that reservation is open for hunting. I do know that they pride themselves on their elk and deer hunts. As far as the Mescalero Apache Reservation goes, there's a lot of guys that make most of their living off guided hunts that are up there. So it is open as far as that goes. But like I said, the stories that I heard from some of my older cousins and some of the older gentlemen that were able to talk to me about this stuff after I had my encounter, you know, it was basically, if you knew somebody who lived up there, you could go hunting. So that's kind of how they did that. And it's been more regulated here in the newer days, but I can't honestly say right now if it's more regulated. I'm sure it is. But that's kind of more so the background of that is that it was pretty predominant to go up there and go hunting, especially back in the 80s, 90s, and possibly early 2000s from my knowledge.
Okay. So this area, the canyon lands, why do you think this area would be really attractive to a Bigfoot? You know, did it have more food, water, and shelter areas for them than, say, another part of the reservation?
I would venture to say yes, being that this was only a certain location that had several sightings. If you did talk to, I remember that there was a wildfire that happened back in Redoso back in the early 2000s. I believe it was 2002. And this was a fire that my dad was actually on because my dad worked for the Forest Service. And he actually picked up a lady from the El Paso airport. She lived up in Mescalero. He kind of struck up conversation with her, as you know, being that the Native Americans are very quiet and very reserved. And he had struck up conversation about, you know, stuff on the Mescalero Apache Reservation. I don't know how it came about, but the lady basically looked at my dad and she's like, yeah, you don't go outside after the sun goes down. And of course, my dad being my dad, he kind of wanted to get more information on that. So he wanted to talk to her more. And after she said that, she really just went quiet and went reserved. So I figured that from that story that I had heard from my dad on top of what happened to us, and then when you talk to other Native Americans that are in those areas, you know, it's kind of one of those you venture to see that the whole reservation is a hotspot for that stuff. Being that my encounter was only in a specific area, you're kind of, okay, yeah, this is what happened over here. But then when you're talking to other people that have been on that reservation, they're like, well, this is what happened to me. This is what, you know, what was being tossed at me, what was being thrown at me. It's kind of a whole hotspot up in that area. And the thing is that in southern New Mexico, you have Alamogordo, where I grew up, which is White Sands National Monument down in the basin. And then from the basin of Alamogordo to Cloudcroft, within 30 minutes, you go from 4,200 feet elevation to 9,000 feet elevation. And then on top of that, you have Mescalero and Redoso, which is a little bit further north. So you're coming out of a valley up into these mountains. So it's a decent range of mountains in the southern part of New Mexico. So, you know, as far as these creatures being there, I'm sure they've been there for a long time. You're just now finding people that are willing to talk about when they've seen them or when they've come across them. It just seems that the bigger patterns are closer to the reservation. So I don't know what's going on there as far as what the reservations have in connection with an actual Bigfoot /Sasquatch, but they, you know, when you speak about Native American culture, how they talk about how they've been there for before the reservation was there, you know, they're a lot more open to it. But the thing is, when somebody looks at you and says, yeah, you don't really go out of the house after dark, you're like, whoa, wait a minute, what are you talking about? And then they just completely shut down. So it's kind of one of those, I would venture to say they're more open to it, but they really don't want to talk about it either.
Well, I wonder, and I'm not trying to put too much onto a Bigfoot as far as their thinking into things. And I'm not trying to say they're not intelligent. It's just, I'm not trying to you know, put any human emotions onto them, right? So I wonder, right, though, because you're talking about the respect that Native Americans have always had for Bigfoot and the healthy fear that they have for Bigfoot. I mean, I've been around Native American peoples in Washington State who talk about generations of their family leaving salmon, you know, while they're fishing, they'll catch six and leave two or whatever it is, you know, whatever the numbers are. They always leave something behind for the Bigfoot. So I wonder then if the Bigfoot in the area that we're talking about in New Mexico, if the Bigfoot realized, well, these people do, they know we're here, they give us the distance that we need and want, and maybe there is some kind of a for lack of a better term, a gifting situation. I don't really enjoy that term a lot of the times, but something that they will leave behind out of respect for the Bigfoot so that they don't come in and take, you know, their women and children or whatever it is. And I don't know. Right. I just am wondering if the Bigfoot somehow, they know that, and they stick around there maybe longer than they would in another area. I mean, if you're in New Mexico, I'd imagine it'd be a little bit easier living than if you're a Bigfoot in Canada, right? Where you're just socked in with snow 8 or 9 months of the year. So maybe they'll like it down there. Besides the weather, the people respect them a little bit more too.
Right. And no, I would agree with you there fully 100%, just because, and that's the one thing that I have noticed over the years, is that when I am able to talk about this, when it comes to Native Americans, whenever I do speak to them, they're very receptive and they're very open. Like, oh, okay. Yeah. You had a sighting, like you ran across them. Like, no, they're, and I had one guy tell me, he said, well, you know, you were scared in that situation. It wasn't coming after you. If you didn't feel in danger, then he was just kind of minding his own business and you were fine. Okay. Well, yeah, I didn't feel fine at the time. You know, it just, I was trying to process the whole thing. He said, yeah, but you weren't, he wasn't coming after you. So, it, you know, you weren't in a dangerous situation. And as long as you don't provoke them, you won't be in a dangerous situation. And it's like, wow, you know, you can talk about your encounter with these people and they're like, yeah, sure. And then you have neighbors of my parents or something where when it's brought up in conversation and a lady looks at you and says, you're full of shit, you're basically exploding on her with tears in your eyes, it makes you more receptive to being talked about. The Native Americans are open to this, so I can talk about it. If it's not a Native American, I'm not going to talk about it, you know, because you're facing the skepticism that everybody has, and there's skeptics out there, and I understand that. But it's kind of one of those, you know, when somebody, after, you know, my encounter, when somebody looks me in the face and says, oh, you're full of it, I'm going to get a little angry. I have a very short fuse when it comes to that. So when you look at me and say, oh, you're full of it, that you're fixing to get a earful as far as I'm concerned. So that is the one thing that I did learn over these few years, kind of getting over that traumatic experience, was that, you know, when you come across people who are of Native American descent, they're more receptive to you talking about your encounter than those who aren't.
Well, and talking about real life encounters, people that share their real life encounters like you're doing, there is the gambit that it runs is huge. And it also mirrors itself if you're looking at even movies. You know, you've got John Lithgow in Harry and the Hendersons, and then you take like a Bryce Johnson in Willow Creek, and look at the difference in those two situations with a Bigfoot. The thing is, though, that does mirror real life. You have very positive experiences where people are, and again, I'll use the word I don't truly like, and that's gifting. They will, you know, go in their backyard and they're gifting, and they're the Bigfoot are then leaving presents for them. And I'm not saying that doesn't happen. I just, the word gifting gets me, just like I guess the word dogman gets me. But
right,
then you do have situations where people are going, these are not to be messed with. And yes, maybe the Bigfoot's bride situation is, you know, a little, well, see, but now I'm going to cancel out what I was just about to say. I said it was maybe reaching a little bit, but it's actually not, because if you look at the Native American lore, and I even said it earlier, they do come in for the women and children in some of these tales, right? So Willow Creek is kind of just a docudrama in a way, if you want to really label it. So, well, thinking, go ahead.
It's kind of funny that you actually mentioned that, because after my experience for the first like 4 or 5 years, my mom, she would call me and she'd say, Harry and the Hendersons are on. And literally I'd go, not funny. You know, because you know, I've seen Harry and the Hendersons, like it was a comedy. I adored it. But after that experience, it's like, oh, Harry and the Hendersons are on. It's like, I don't care. I'm not funny. Like, I'm not taking you know, because she would kind of say it in this little giggly voice to try and take the edge off the conversation. I'm like, no, that's not funny.
Well, have you watched Willow Creek or Exists?
I had seen parts of Willow Creek before my encounter. So it was kind of one of those, like, after that, I have not watched it since my encounter.
I gotcha.
I wouldn't be really receptive to it because I'm sure I would probably have a freak out moment.
You wouldn't like it. No, you wouldn't like it. Because I can try to put myself in both of the situations in Willow Creek and then Exists. And you're kind of going, and I've said it a million times, as much as I want to see a Bigfoot, there are boundaries, you know. You don't want to feel like you're going to actually perish to have a sighting or during a sighting. I would hazard to say maybe Willow Creek and Exists is not going to be up your alley. Maybe another 10 years, try it. I don't know.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah, give it like more time.
With, you know, The Unexplained with William Shatner, I know there's been a couple of episodes. I watched that. The Expedition Bigfoot, I know I've been keeping up on that right now. There was a documentary that was on Netflix a few years ago, and it was the, I don't know if you ever saw it, it was the Todd Standing documentary that he made of all of his evidence and filming and stuff when he was up in Canada. Me and my dad were actually watching that one day, and my mom came home and we rewatched it. And unfortunately, I was still in that little bit of period where I was still kind of freaked out. So the one scene where Todd Standing is with his video camera and the one Bigfoot face comes across from behind the tree, I basically come up off the couch. You know, it was kind of one of those that was like, I wasn't expecting that, but it was just kind of a quick flashback. And I know there's skeptics and, you know, that, oh, that's not real, he's making that all up there. But the one that was convincing for me for the Todd Standing one was that after he had got all that evidence in that area was when he told a lot of the Bigfoot researchers that a couple of months later in that area, you know, he basically was awoken from his tent that night. And there was basically a helicopter coming in and there was no lights, no, you know, it was basically darkness. He could hear it. When he went tracking the next day, he found several military footprints. And later that night, he recalled that there was a lot of gunfire going on. So it's like, what are they doing whenever they come into these units? You know, what does the government know that we don't, type deal? And I know I'm getting kind of into the conspiracy theory as far as this goes, but it just, after you have an encounter like what happened with me, it makes you wonder about that kind of stuff. Because here's a guy who's dedicated his life to researching these creatures, and then the entire area that he was researching is just basically wiped out overnight.
Yeah, I mean, it could happen. You've heard of black helicopters and guys in dark outfits coming and swooping into an area before. So who knows, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes, okay, ma'am. So last question. And you kind of hinted at this earlier, but I want to ask it straight out. Do you wish that you would have never seen this thing?
You know, honestly, for the first 5 years after my encounter, if you would have asked me that question, I would have said yes. Just because that, even though I didn't feel in danger. It was just, you know, walking across the road and we just happened to stumble upon it. Traumatically, it just left me in a place where you don't want to go to sleep at night. Now, you know, going on over 10 years later, I am glad that it did happen because it's made me more open and receptive to not only Bigfoot, but paranormal, UFOs, everything like that. It just kind of, it's like a basically an awakening. So it's the best way I can describe that is for your question is that it's 50-50. The first 5 years, no, I would have not wanted to run across this creature. But now that I look at it 10 years later, over 10 years later, I'm glad it happened, because I can honestly say, as a person, I've seen what these people are trying to get on camera now and the evidence that they're trying to gather. So now more so, I would say it's probably 60-40. 60%, I'm glad it happened. 40%, you know, it was still a pretty traumatic experience. So I'm more open to it now than I was after it first happened. So if I danced around the question, I am sorry, but that's the best way that I can describe it as far as that goes.
No, that's not dancing. You're just being honest. Well, no, Aaron, I cannot thank you enough for being willing to come on, for choosing me to come on with and share your encounter. You're the perfect guest, really, because you got a hold of me on Insta and you're like, hey, I have a Bigfoot story for you. And I'm like, great, let's schedule. And that's it. Like, I didn't know any details or anything. And that is my absolute favorite way to record with somebody.
Well, and like I said, just, you know, when I had reached out over Instagram, I had seen your stuff, and I'm just like, you know, I feel like I can talk to this person, because the receptiveness for hearing an encounter, it was like, yeah, absolutely. I'm willing to open up about this. I mean, we're going on over 10 years and I still get shaky about it, but I can talk about it now, you know, especially when I'm watching all these documentaries and stuff like that of what happened to me. It's like, absolutely. If you were willing to take the time out of your Saturday, I'm more than willing to take the time out of my Saturday in order to tell you my encounter. So I appreciate you reaching back out to me after I had messaged you. So I'm glad we were able to knock this out today. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, ditto, man. I really do. And once this airs, I know I'll be getting correspondence. I can forward that to you. Actually, I'll get your email. We'll exchange that on Instagram, but I'll get your email address. And then if I get any correspondence from, you know, anybody in that area or anything with reports, I will make sure to forward that to you. And then it's up to you if you want to get in touch with somebody.
If anybody gets after the podcast airs, if anybody does get in touch, I'll be very receptive to, you know, getting in contact with them if they've had any experiences like what mine was.
Yeah, especially specifically from that reservation. I would love to hear more stories from there. I know a lot of people are very reserved about that. I totally understand it. Aaron understands it better than anybody. But please, please reach out to me, Shannon at endofthefrayradio.com. Yeah, thanks again, Aaron.
Yes, ma'am. You have a good rest of your Saturday and have a wonderful weekend.
Well, I'm so-and-so. I was given this name by my parents. I've been to such and such a college. I've done these things in my profession. I produce a little fire. Buddha says, forget it. That's not true. That's some story. That's all gone. That's all past. I want to see the real you are now. Well, nobody knows who that is. Because we don't know ourselves except through listening to our ignorance. And consulting our memories. But then there's a real evil, and that again leads us back to this question. Who are you? That is the real you. We shall see how they play with this exam. By the koans, to get you to come out of your shell and find out who you really are. that after your funeral, you know, you will suddenly become somebody different, living somewhere else. They will say reincarnation means this, that if you sitting here now are really convinced that you're the same person who walked in at the door half an hour ago, you're being reincarnated. If you are liberated, you understand that you're not. The past doesn't exist. That's the only real you that there is. The Zen master Dogen put it this way. He said, spring does not become summer. First there is summer, and then there is spring.
Recitation of a history.